My wife and I have two sons, and when they were younger, we lived on a corner lot in Lubbock, Texas. At the end of the block lived Cameron. Cameron was the neighborhood nuisance. Cameron was the son of divorced parents. He lived with his mom, and out of necessity, she let Cameron oftentimes roam the neighborhood, largely unsupervised much of the time. Cameron would race across the yard on his bike, which he occasionally left in our front yard, along with balls and all sorts of other things that we considered giving to Goodwill, but we never did so. Cameron was the kind of kid who never lets your kids have their turn at hitting a ball. One day we found that Cameron had climbed up the tree in our front yard onto our rooftop and was coaxing our four-year-old son to come up there and join him on the roof. We lived in that space where a lot of parents live, trying to befriend and reach out to Cameron and his mom while also trying to protect our young boys from too much of Cameron's influence. So on Halloween one day, Cameron's mom decided that it would be fun to dress up for Halloween and to surprise her son. And so she asked if Cameron could stay with us for an hour or two, then we could bring him to his house where she would dress up in a witch's costume and surprise him. Despite our reservations about the glamorized horror of Halloween, it seemed like an opportunity to build a deeper relationship with our neighbor, and so we obliged. I don't think we were prepared for how thoroughly committed Cameron's mom was to the disguise. With some outfits, right, it's pretty easy to discern and decipher who the person is behind the costume, but this wasn't true for Cameron's mom. She had purchased a rubberized witch's mask that covered her whole face. She had a conical hat that stood several feet above her head and a cape that concealed any hint of this being the body of his mother. We came down the block, we crossed the sidewalk, we approached the familiar front door to Cameron's house, and at first he bore the excitement of most childhood candy seekers. But when a witch opened the door and started her haunting cackle, he stopped dead in his tracks. Completely rattled, his countenance fell, and he started backing away slowly from the door. The cackle turned more playful, but Cameron was not seeing through the disguise. He continued to back away, and he may have took tail and ran were we not with him, and our bodies in the way of stopping him from making a bolt. Well, she persisted until the threshold moment was reached where concern finally dawns that she could perhaps unduly be traumatizing her son, and she pulled off the mask. Immediately, Cameron pivoted. He grinned and he started his pilgrimage home. But his mom had invested too much in the disguise to let it go too easily, so she put the mask back on. And immediately, Cameron once again started backing away. She took the mask on and off several times. Cameron couldn't reconcile these contrasting realities that stood before him. So back and forth he went between the horror and the hospitality, the sorceress and the solace. I thought about that story on subsequent Halloweens, and I wondered how it may serve as a metaphor for life and for faith. Many, perhaps, are those who believe themselves to be walking along a safe and familiar pathway, and quite unexpectedly, a spook suddenly shows up and gives them a good haunting. A change in family status, a turn of events in our work lives, an inner loss, an unexpected diagnosis, an experience of emotional suffering, or the lingering memory of a painful childhood. Panic petrifies us, and we back away. And what often assaults us in such moments is whether, by faith, we can hold on to the reality that behind what is presenting itself as terrifying is a benevolent face, a presence that will see us through. Now, you may be thinking that this is a sermon about Halloween, and perhaps in a rather tangential way it is, but that's not really the focus of the sermon. It's only a way of framing the rest of the message. Today is Halloween, but it's also superseded by a greater day that we've already called attention to, Reformation Day. On October 31st in 1517, Martin Luther nailed 95 theses to the Wittenberg door, sparking what most regard as the beginning of the Reformation. I'm a fifth-generation descendant of a German missionary named Karl Kern, who in 1890 came to pastor a United Evangelical Lutheran church that had been started about 25 years earlier and get this, Fayette County, Texas. It was the second oldest Lutheran church ever established in Texas. Carl had 10 children, which we refer to at family reunions as the 10 tribes of the Kern family. So I would be remiss today if I didn't preach on the Reformation. And I'm grateful for the rare opportunity to honor my heritage, to which I'm deeply grateful, and to bring all of us to a celebration of our Protestant heritage with the focus on the Reformation. Now, in 30 plus years of ministry, I don't think I've ever preached a sermon that expounded on history rather than on a biblical text. But that's what I want to try today. I'll remind you as good Wesleyans that we believe in scripture, reason, experience, and tradition as sources of truth. And so I think I can avoid going off the rails and bring us full circle in the end. So Martin Luther. Martin grew up in a home by our contemporary standards. We might suggest that discipline was regarded as rather harsh. His father Hans was born a peasant. Yet because Hans was not the preferential one in the birth order, no inheritance was promised to him. So as an enterprising man, he moved the family and he became a miner. Because he was Catholic, he would pray to Saint Anne. Anne was the mother of the mother of Jesus and was often evoked in prayers to protect and to make prosperous mining. By most estimations, Hans' prayers were answered. He made a good living mining, and eventually he came to his own mining enterprise. But the work was consuming, and business matters could sometimes produce in Hans bouts of rather intense rage. Luther's mother, Margarita, was also a praying woman, but one of strict discipline. And despite Hans' success at mining, they lived the village life, which meant that oftentimes Margarita was sent into the forest to gather wood. And in many villages, German paganism mixed with Catholic folklore. And so the forests were regarded as being inhabited by elves and gnomes and spirits and witches that could seduce humans to sin or induce in them states of melancholy. In fact, later in life, Luther wrote that he believed that there were whole lands that were inhabited by devils. The waters in some regions were the abode of captive demons. Well, having found a way out of an impoverished existence, Luther's father had high aspirations for young Martin. He wanted him, first of all, to be a jurist, a lawyer, with the possibility of holding esteem in public office. He wanted Luther to get married, and through his financial success, he hoped that Martin would develop the means so that, see, he could take care of his parents in their old age. Hans, in fact, purchased a book of the law, and he presented it to Martin, indicating the vocational pathway for his son that would be the reward for Hans' sacrificial labor of his work. So in Martin's day, both home life and schooling were governed by strict rules, but not in the absence of a high regard that Luther apparently felt for both his parents and his teachers. Luther recounted later in his life that he once stole a nut and that his mother caned him for it until she drew blood. But he comments that in all of this, she meant well. Similarly, the boys at school were drilled in learning Latin, and punishment also came by way of the rod. The practice in the classroom was that one of the better students was appointed to be the wolf, and his task was to catch any student from speaking Latin or who lapsed into speaking German. If you were caught speaking German, you were given a donkey mask that fit over your entire head that you had to wear until you caught someone else speaking German. Demerits were given, and at the end of the week, a birch rod was used to inflict the number of strokes that one was due. So religious and educational life in these medieval times were all oriented toward creating God-fearing people. Hell could be evoked and stoked in order to drive people to the sacraments of the church. And if you despaired, well, there was the doctrine of purgatory and the purchase of indulgences by which you could ease your conscience a bit by shortening the time that you spent in purgatory. People lived in the stark awareness that a day was coming in which their lives would be called into account. In fact, Ronald Banton, who writes one of the biographies of Luther's life, said that he found a chronicle that was published in German in 1493. Now be mindful, right? In 1492, Columbus sailed the ocean blue. A new land has just been discovered. No mention of this at all is made in this chronicle. Instead, what is prominent in the chronicle is Christ the Judge sitting on a rainbow. Out of his left ear protrudes the sword of judgment, indicating, "Depart from me into everlasting fire." Out of the right ear protrude a lily, meaning, "Well done, good and faithful servant." And the question that was presented in the day was, how do you avoid the sword and how do you grab the lily? Luther was terror-stricken by the image of Christ the Judge. So it may be a little conjecturing on my part, but stunning to me are the scare-fest images that might have been active in Martin's consciousness. A donkey head, a father who could on occasion turn irascible, saints and gnomes and witches, and above all, Christ the Judge, for whom Luther simply could not escape. Well, as a young adult, Luther follows the directives that his father had set for him. He enrolls in the University of Erfurt. He studies diligently, and he receives high honors for his master's degree. And despite having good rapport with his teachers, Luther is also given, apparently, to some rather severe bouts of depression. Some regarded it as a psychological complex of tristitia, excessive sadness, and severe melancholy. When Martin is 21 years old, on foot, walking, returning home from the University of Erfurt, he gets caught in a fierce thunderstorm. A lightning bolt strikes and throws him to the ground. He reaches the point of acute panic, and he summons the aid of Saint Anne to save him and pledges to God that if God will save me, I will become a monk. And God spares his life, and Martin is true to his promise. He enters a monastery, and he begins preparing for holy orders. The transition to religious life is, of course, not welcomed at all by his father, because Luther is now no longer headed toward becoming a lawyer. He's pledged a vow of celibacy in his future, relinquishing marriage, and he's committed to a life that has nothing that will contribute to the kin-keeping that Hans had always wanted. So Hans apparently receives the news with much cursing, and it's not until he loses two other sons to death that he begins an internal rapprochement, acquiescing to the reality that his son Martin, has become a monk. Well, on his part, Martin submits to all the disciplines of the cloister life, and he passes through the year of probation, taking on the full vow that now epitomizes the pathway of those who were most diligent on a pathway towards saints, fitting for those earnest in their religious devotion. 2 years later, at the age of 23, Luther has undergone enough preparation to perform his first Mass. It's timed in such a way that his father can come and be present, who's not seen him since presenting him with the book that pointed the way to his becoming a lawyer. Hans, apparently, having suppressed some of his aggression, he rides in and he brings a gift to the monastery. Now, recall that in Catholic tradition, during Mass, the sacrifice of Calvary is reenacted. The bread and the wine become the flesh and the blood of Christ. God is actually believed to appear in the transubstantiated elements. The priest who consecrates the element is regarded as possessing a power that no angel in heaven has been permitted. In fact, it's this role that places the priest in a more lofty status than even the emperor, that plays prominently in the separation of church and state that plays out in some huge implications in the next decades. And Luther seems well as he enters into performing the Mass until he becomes to the beginning and confronts the words, "We offer unto thee the living, the true, the eternal God." And suddenly Luther is seized with terror. Who is he to address the one before whom all men and women should tremble? How should a miserable little pygmy ask anything when we are mere dust full of sin, yet now speaking to the living and eternal God? the German word that Luther uses to describe his state of being undone and that often beset him has no easy English equivalent, anfechtung. It can carry the connotation of a trial that's sent by God to test a person, but it can also convey an assault sent by the devil to destroy a person. Anfechtung, the doubt, the turmoil, the desolation, the despair that pervades the human condition. Terrified and shaking, by most accounts, Luther spills the communion wine and only by some effort completes the Mass. Luther finds no consolation in the presence of his heavenly Father. After Mass, he sits at the table with his earthly Father, perhaps hoping for some consolation and reconciliation on the horizontal plane. And he says, "Dear Father, why were you so contrary to my becoming a monk?" Up to this point, Hans has concealed his disgust, but with the question, he doesn't seem to be able to contain his displeasure. "You are a learned scholar, Martin. Have you never read that you should honor your father and mother? And here you have left your father and mother to look after ourselves in our old age." Apparently, it creates quite a scene in the otherwise serene monastery. Martin retorts back, "But Father, I could do you more good by my prayers than if I had stayed in the world." And then apparently he recounts something of the thunderbolt whereby God had summoned him to his call, to which his father replies, "God grant that it was not an apparition of the devil." Now, several who write about Luther's life speculate that the excessive harshness that Luther experienced from his father, compounded perhaps by the strictness of his educational experience, account for what became a preoccupation with God as an avenger, to whom Luther would go to extreme measures to try to appease. Whatever good works Luther might do to save himself, he resolved to perform. Sometimes fasting for days on end, engaging in vigils beyond what was required even by his monastic order, stripping blankets off of his bed until he almost froze himself to death in order to mortify the desires of the flesh. And yet, despite all of his stringent efforts, he couldn't balance the ledger and find a way to outrun his offenses with penances. So he turned to the only source that he knew, to the church, for help. If the merits of Christ had been deposited in the church, then maybe the church could determine in detail how many years one could get freed from purgatory, and this could help transfer some merits to him, whose account seemed to be, in his own judgment, so overdrawn. Soon there's a trip to Rome, where relics of the church could be visited, and each relic could spare you from years of purgatory and reduce the number. Here also were steps that allegedly were where Christ stood before Pontius Pilate, and the church believed that if the steps could be climbed and an Our Father pronounced on every step, then a soul could be sprung from purgatory. So Luther climbs the steps on his knees on behalf of an uncle, praying the Our Father at every step. And yet, with the same absence of assurance that anything has been settled with God, Luther gets to the top step and simply says, "Who knows whether it is so?" Luther returns from Rome, and he's assigned to Wittenberg. And there are at least two things that emerge in Luther's journey that prove to be providential. One is that he's appointed to teach through the Book of Psalms. And the second is that in the practice of his order, when he goes to confession, he's assigned a confessor, a superior who in the sacrament of confession acts much like we might call a spiritual director or a mentor, Johann von Staupitz. Now, in Catholic tradition, right, there are seven sacraments, all of which are given to mediate to human beings God's help and favor. And one of those sacraments is confession or penance. So seeking solace, but fearful that there might be the possibility that he could leave some sin unconfessed, Luther is unremittingly scrupulous in his engagement of this means of grace. He confesses frequently, daily. Sometimes he would spend as long as 6 hours with his confessor, running through the seven deadly sins and the commandments, wrestling perpetually with the terror that God had brought upon him and the threat of eternal damnation. Dr. Staupitz, growing weary of the repeated confession that pours forth from Luther, at one point he exclaims to Luther, It could not have been Christ who terrified you. Christ is the one who consoles. Martin, God does not hate you. You hate God. So it's in this context that Martin begins teaching through the Psalms, seeing them as a foreshadowing of the life of Christ, which brings him finally to Psalm 22 and the text that Liz read so moving for us this morning. And Martin sees in Psalm 22, beginning with the words, my God, why have you forsaken me?" an unmistakable reverence to the words spoken by Christ on the cross. And it dawns on Luther that Christ had felt forsaken by God, abandoned, deserted. Christ, too, had felt unfestum. The utter desolation that Luther could not shake and for which he said he could not endure for more than a tenth of an hour. Christ had been rejected of men, but Christ also felt the rejection of God. And Luther knew from his own despair that this could be felt as deeply and perhaps even worse than the nails and the crowns of thorns. But why? Why would Christ have to experience unfestum? Luther knew why he felt it, because he was impure in the presence of a holy God, a pygmy in the hands of the Almighty. But why would Christ suffer unfestum? The only answer was that he could find was in the book of Romans. He who is without sin became sin on our behalf and took on himself the iniquity of us all, participating with us in our alienation. In the book of Romans, the word for justice could convey two different meanings, justice and justification. And Luther would know that a judge, if he sees something of resolve and worth in someone who is convicted, he doesn't overturn the law, the sentence remains, but the justice can appeal to the reformation of a person in a way that's better than exacting a pound of flesh. Now, the human analogy begins to break down quickly because God doesn't condition his forgiveness based on any achievement of our own. But Luther was on his way to a full appropriation of justification by faith alone. The judge who sits upon the throne judging sinners, in his judgment, suffers with those he must condemn and feels himself with them subject to condemnation. The all-terrible one was also the all-merciful one. Wrath and love fuse at the cross. It's not that the Son placates an irate Father and denies our sin. The moral rectitude of God is preserved, but in some inexplicable way, God reconciles the world to himself. The mask was being removed, and behind it was an inexplicable love. The most holy and the most loving, how inscrutable are the ways of God. Now, it is, of course, Luther's preface to the book of Romans that's being read when John Wesley finds his heart strangely warmed at a society gathering Aldersgate Street. And there's so much more to Luther's story that's worth telling and retelling on this day of Reformation, and so many different applications that we could make. But here's the one I'd like to offer you this morning. We live in vastly different times and different socio-cultural contexts than Luther. And yet we face a generation for whom the struggle of unfestum may not seem so distant. Many are those today who are seeking to find a God of love and mercy, but when they've tried to open that door, they found misrepresentations of a God that comes closer to resembling something to be feared. A childhood wound, a judgmental friend, a fallen leader, a hypocrisy. Like Cameron, they've been bewitched, and the face of God has become presented as a monstrous, devilish, a horror to be distanced from. Many who are deconstructing the ghoulish way that Christianity was presented to them, wondering if there's anything left to build with when the wrecking is done. And our great privilege is to use whatever words or means of being able to say to them, God is not angry with you, and to accompany them on their journey until God is revealed in truth and his beauty is known through the inexplicable revelation of the cross. And so when you do that, when you accompany those and abide with them in their struggle and their suffering, who knows, that you may be accompanying and looking into the very face of the next great reformer that the church so desperately needs.